Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
On this week's episode, a global internet apocalypse is upon us. Or is it? Twitter turns 7. Blizzard's next Warcraft is not an RPG, but a card game. Streaming video heats up. The iPhones on T-Mobile. Scientists plan a real Jurassic Park. And a dongle joke that spiraled way out of control. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I'm really excited to hear about your experience, Tosin, while you were gone last week at PAX. But before that, I'm just going to cut in and mention the thing that I've been watching over the last couple of weeks is a show on that premiered on the BBC, on BBC Three a couple of weeks ago called In the Flesh. And this is an interesting drama by a newcomer, Dominic Mitchell. I don't think he's done anything. I think he was part of like a BBC Young Writers intern program. And it takes place in the present day, but it takes place a few years after a zombie apocalypse has swept the earth. And basically, everyone who died within the year 2009 was resurrected as a zombie, and they went on to wreak havoc across the earth and cannibalize people. And unlike most other literary zombies, you can't get infected by these zombies. They bite you and they eat you, but you don't yourself turn into zombies. But in this alternate reality, a treatment has been discovered for what they call partially deceased syndrome. The zombies are treated and they're being reintegrated back into normal society, a society that has since come to despise them. And resent them for basically the near extinction of the rest of humanity. So, I mean, really, the story is sort of an allegory for like race hatred and mob violence and the reintegration of society of a class of people who were shunned and despised, and how that affects the rest of society. It's really well done, really well told. I don't think it's available here in the U.S. Being able to watch it here in the States is kind of a gray area. But if you're in the U.K., you should be seeing it on BBC Three. And if you're not in the U.K., there are ways to watch this. And it's possible that it may come to BBC America at some point.
Yeah, BBC has a lot of quality TV shows. I mean, I started watching Black Mirror, and it's tremendous. If you haven't seen Black Mirror, you should also tune into that as well. Yeah.
It's Charlie Brooker's show, and just a phenomenal. I mean, it's really sort of it inherits the mantle from Rod Serling's Twilight Zone series. I think.
Twilight Zone for the new technological age.
Yep. Yep, just some great shows. I wish that show would come to BBC America as well. Maybe it will.
So yeah, hopefully.
So Tosin, you were gone the last week, and you were at PAX East. Now, first of all, explain briefly for anyone who isn't aware what PAX is.
So PAX is the Penny Arcade Expo. It's founded by the guys who run Penny Arcade, the web comic or web series. And it's really a convention that displays the love of gaming. It's a currently three-day convention held in Boston and Seattle. And they have a new show coming up soon in Australia. The one in Seattle this coming year is going to actually be 4 days, the first time they have a 4-day panel. But at PAX, you can go to various panels discussing, you know, things from video game music to social commentary to, you know, growing up and parenting youths through internet communities, as well as there's an expo floor with new games, indie titles, and a lot of offshooting rooms where you can both play old console games, new console games, and, you know, jam out with friends. There are a couple stages there for Rock Band as well as Dance Central. And nice. It's really, the way I see it is it's a gathering of like-minded individuals who enjoy gaming, enjoy talking about gaming, and come together as a community. So it's a really fun event. Definitely recommend checking it out if you get a chance.
So it's kind of like a electronic entertainment expo, but instead of being like a business-to-business convention to sell to other people in the gaming industry, it's for the gamers themselves.
Yeah, I really consider it that way. It's for the gamers, by the gamers. You know, there is media, of course, because there has to be media at these events, but media really don't get any special – you don't really get any special privileges in general for having a media badge. You have to wait in the same lines. You are basically an attendee as well. And I think there's this camaraderie that comes together. I remember at my first PAX, which I went to, heading towards one of the Friday night concerts, someone started mm-hmm. breaking out in singing Bohemian Rhapsody, and then the entire crowd moving there chimed in, and it became this lengthy chorus of people singing it all as a group on their way to the actual concerts.
That's awesome.
And the concerts themselves are actually pretty awesome too.
They do a video game music concert.
Yeah, so you've got two nights of concerts. Typically, you'll have one night which is more rock-heavy with the Proto Men, which are kind of like a Mega Man band. They've got VGO, Video Game Orchestra, which is awesome, and a lot of other groups. And then you also have another more light-hearted night with Jonathan Colton and
nice.
And a bunch of other musicians, Paul and Storm. And it's really this good, eclectic mix of people who are interested and make video game music in terms of, you know, it may not be directly about video games, but it's that kind of geeky side.
Like geek culture.
Right.
So what are some of the things that you saw that impressed you at this year's PAX East?
So this year's PAX East, I think, is my 7th PAX I've been to, or 8th PAX wow. I've been to. So my experience with PAX is maybe a little different than others. I actually help volunteer, and typically I'm working in the bring your own computer section, BYOC, running some contests or helping out in the PC free play section. So feel free to swing on by if you ever go to future PAXes. And that being said, what I find really interesting about PAX is that you can take different sort of paths. So I remember my first mm-hmm. PAX was more about hitting up panels, hearing from other comics and artists, like the artist of Foxtrot, and you know, exploring concerts, while other people stick just to the expo, or other people stick to playing other sorts of games. So for me, I would say this PAX, I did try and do a little bit more in terms of getting a little bit of coverage of what was coming out, both from like indie and normal game selection. But I didn't really stay in any of the lengthy lines to play some of the more killer titles, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the titles which I saw on the show floor were, you know, the Elder Scrolls Online video game. They had this huge video screen, which this awesome cinematic. It was really epic and very pretty. There was, you know, stuff for Assassin's Creed Black Flag, Splinter Cell, a new DuckTales remastered game, which was kind of interesting.
What?
And of course, yep, a new DuckTales game. And of course, Blizzard's Hearthstone, which would be coming out, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit mm-hmm. later. But I want to mention, I guess, a few titles that I actually really got my hands on, and I played a little bit. Oh, one other title which I should mention is if you ever played the game Bastion, the guys are releasing a new game called Transistor, which I didn't get a chance to touch it, but it looks incredibly beautiful. Definitely with a lot of style and elegance that they've, you know, previously had in Bastion in this game. So for the games which I actually got my hands on, I'm going to mention a few of them, and these may not be titles that you may regularly hear, as they're not the big names, but if you search on the web, and I'm sure we can put some links to them if anyone finds those interesting or curious. One of those games is called Dive Kick, and the way Dive Kick actually started out was kind of funny. It was originally just a funny parody Kickstarter that was really successful and actually got a publisher signed to it. And really, the game is simply a two-button game. You have the button for diving and for kicking. And each successful kick is kind of like a fatality. It wins the match. Mm-hmm. And so you have to – it's kind of this fun game where you're jumping around trying to kick your other kick your competitor as this silly battle. And it was actually a lot of fun. I played it on a PS Vita. Where I had two buttons and a friend had the other two. And it was just really unique and surprisingly good time for such a simple game. It's really cool to see innovation in that kind of space as well.
Games nowadays are all about how many different buttons you can control on the controller and what buttons do what. And I love to see them pared down to sort of like the baser elements. Like, you know, there's some games on web games, some flash games on the web that literally only require one button. You don't even have to move. I love games like that because it's
right, like Robot Unicorn Attack. You know,
right. I mean, it just shows like an incredible amount of inventiveness on the creator's part.
Right. Another game which I briefly touched. I was more of a. It's actually funny because I was watching a colleague play this game and also watching his reactions, talk to the developer about it a bit, was a game called Daylight. And really, it's kind of this game which allows you to explore areas. And I think what it's really known for is its ambiance and audio. So there, he was using some pretty effective audio levels and channels to really push out the scare factor. The other thing which the developer really mentioned is that the game actually changes each time you play it. Hmm. So, for example, if at some point something scary used to pop out when you open doors, well, it may not necessarily do that on your next playthrough.
So
it's trying to keep this unique, fresh style.
That's almost evil.
Yes, exactly. Actually, my friend took off the headphones and he was like, screw this, I'm not playing this anymore, because he was locked in. And it's really, you know, a lot of the games which you play of the similar vein may not get that much traction because, you know, if you're playing it with other people around, right? Mm-hmm. He was in the middle of a show floor with lights all about, people mingling all about, and it was just him and the headset, and he was freaked out to the extent that he took them off and didn't want to play again. So it'll be interesting to see how they develop, and I think they're aiming for like a $20 pricing fee for that.
Oh, nice.
For that game. Yeah.
Nice.
Another title that I got to see was called Children of Liberty. It's this 2D, 3D platform game, which is kind of cool because the methodology that it changes from 2D to 3D. But really what you're doing, and kind of funny that we were in Massachusetts for PAX East with BCEC,
sure.
You need to run to warn the countryside of Red Coat Army. So you basically see a lot of Red Coat Army individuals with flashlights searching about to see if there's anyone there, and you can you can hug the walls and then leap out and take them out. So actually really cool, a little booth. I wish I got a chance to talk to the developer for it, but definitely something I'm going to be looking forward to.
Hmm. Sounds like a little bit like Paul Revere, a little Paul Revere action going on.
Exactly. Exactly. If only we had gotten a chance to toss tea into the waters. Another game which I played was called Shoot Mania, and I think I only played it in a capture the the flag mm-hmm. or capture base slash point style, but it's a really fast-paced game. So it's kind of like, to a certain extent, it's kind of like Counter-Strike, but on speed and more futuristic in terms that you're like dashing sort of lights and you're hopping around on warps and just firing lasers at will. And it was actually, you know, that's kind of a space which has gotten muddled with a lot of games.
Right.
And I typically am not one to really play many of those. I'm more of the co-op style. And,
yeah.
you know, I do get entrenched. In the past, I would, but these days, not as much. And I kind of, you know, it seemed like a game which I could jump in and jump out relatively seamlessly, especially in these days where my time can be lacking.
This is a... an arena shooter by the people who make the Trackmania franchise, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, it definitely is. I think you mentioned that you may have also gotten a chance to play this one.
Yeah, I played this last year at E3, and what I was impressed about. Well, the thing that I've always been impressed by those Trackmania guys is how beautiful everything looks, beautiful and realistic. That's what makes the Trackmania franchise so appealing to me, is that it really feels like you're watching these cars do these amazing acrobatic stunts, because everything else just feels so realistic, lighting and textures. And that's the same goes for this Shoot Mania that I've witnessed, is that everything has this sort of real, like you're really in the middle of this sort of abandoned field with all these obstacles that you can shoot around and behind, and if I recall correctly, you had it wasn't just guns, you had certain other sort of weapons like lasers and RPGs and stuff like that, and it was just a lot of fun. You could get off a few quick games and then you don't have to get too sort of involved, just in and out and go.
Exactly Pretty fast paced game. I guess quickly I did try Diablo 3 on PS3, and you know, it was Diablo. It was actually it was like, you know, any sort of hack and slash game, so to speak. It was I was thinking of God of War, actually, where I was actually just, I know I probably shouldn't have been just charging in and unleashing hell, so to speak. but it was fun. It seemed like it was well made, but, you know, of course, it's not anything new. But I think, as with anything that Blizzard does, I think it was well crafted.
I'm going to hijack our rundown here, and I want to talk about the Blizzard thing first here. So, Blizzard announced during PAX East that they were. A new Warcraft game called Hearthstone Heroes of Warcraft, which is a free-to-play Magic the Gathering-style collectible card game set in the Warcraft universe. And it's going to be available on the iPad, PC, and Mac. Did you get a chance to play this game?
So, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to play it. But I think it's kind of it was a combination of slight disappointed,
really,
on my part. So let me clarify that and say, from my friends who got to play the game, I heard it was enjoyable and that it was a fun game, and a lot of them think it's there to try and challenge what Wizards of the Coast has been able to do with Magic,
right?
As well as it's the new domain for Blizzard to get into and get a greater feel for. And maybe even to flex their muscle slash understand how to do this sort of player versus player competitive system a little better. But for me, you know, there was so much anticipation, and I kind of was hoping for something more than a card game, not to dumb it down a bit. But I was just kind of – yeah. For me, I don't know. I actually recently got Magic on my iPad Mini, and it's a fun game, but it's not something that grips me. It's not something that gripped me in the same way that, you know, World of Warcraft did. And I know I haven't given it a fair chance yet since I haven't played it.
Right.
But, you know, I walked by, I took some photos, and I just didn't feel like
you weren't feeling
spending
it.
My time to stand there and play it. So
I do appreciate the fact that they're reaching into this sort of niche market here. And not necessarily a niche market. I mean, it is growing. I personally have never gotten into the whole, you know, collectible card game. I've never played Magic the Gathering before, but there is a broad fan base for games like this. And
yeah.
I like to see that it's nice to see that they're leveraging the space and they're not necessarily kind of locked into doing the RPG thing that's in their comfort zone.
Yeah, no, I agree there, and it's cool to see them be able to take chances. I mean, one of the things that you even notice at PAX, which is, like I said, there's so many different things for gamers. And in Boston, there's actually a whole floor that is dedicated just to board games, card games, and the like. So it's literally, I'd say, almost as big as the expo floor.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
You can look at it. You'll see some photos if you get a chance to look at my photos. But it's huge, and it's always packed with people. So you know that the desire to play these games are still there. And games of these natures are still evolving. So it's really I think it's a smart move to get a small mobile team in there. You don't have to dedicate huge resources right now, but it's a good change of pace. And, hey, it's good to at least see them be innovative and try something different.
Yeah, you know? I agree. All right, let's move into some of the headlines here. First of all, the internet is reportedly undergoing the biggest DDoS attack in history. If you can't reach Netflix or are having difficulties accessing other sites, it might be due to this huge online fight between Cyberbunker, a Dutch hosting company, and Spamhaus, an anti-spam group. This web war began when Spamhaus blacklisted the Dutch company as spammers. If the cyber attacks escalate, security experts told the New York Times, that people may not be able to reach basic internet services like email and online banking. Cloudflare CEO Matthew Prince told the New York Times, these things are essentially like nuclear bombs. It's so easy to cause so much damage. And Patrick Gilmore, chief architect at Akamai, said, it's the largest publicly announced DDoS attack in the history of the internet. It's distributed denial of service, by the way, is what DDoS stands for. And it's basically when a person or a group sends all of these requests to different websites in such a mass sort of amount that it chokes the site's ability to respond to those requests, and it's basically literally like flooding them where they can't respond, and they're taken down by the flood of information, of data that's coming through. However, we have heard a conflicting report from a report at Gizmodo, who says that if you read beyond a few scary sentences, beyond just the fact that it's the largest internet attack in history, you might wonder, you know, certain questions. Why wasn't my internet slow? And in fact, my internet hasn't been slow even after I read this. Why didn't anyone notice this over the course of the past week when it began? Why isn't anyone without a financial stake in the attack saying the attack was this much of a disaster? Why haven't there been any reports of Netflix outages, as the New York Times and BBC reported? And why do firms that do nothing but monitor the health of the web, like Internet Traffic Report, show zero evidence of the Dutch conflict spilling out into our online backyards? It seems like the only people willing to make any claims about the validity or scope of the attack are directly involved: Spamhaus reps, the group's leader, and most dubiously, Cloudflare, the anti-DDoS firm Spamhaus enlisted to ward off the attack. So this reporter did some research, and he called some backbone operators of the internet, like NTT, for example, and also Renesas, a company that's devoted to monitoring the status of the internet. And neither of those firms noted any blip outside of the local area where this was happening. So this could all be just an enormous, not a hoax, but basically a marketing term or a FUD, you know, something that is enacted to create fear, uncertainty, and distrust to get people to sign on with Cloudflare, the company that whose job is to protect people against the DDoS attacks in that area.
Yeah, you know, my first thought was probably similar to yours was, oh, that happened? Where was I? And I know I was off at a convention, but we were constantly connected. We were playing over the networks, and there was no sluggishness, and neither was there at work. I definitely agree here. They're making a whole lot of nothing because, you know, if we had actually had serious issues with the internet, we would have known. Remember when in Virginia there was an issue with one of the data centers and Netflix went down, as well as some other online services?
Yeah.
We were all aware of that because these were the things that we needed to use on a day-to-day basis. I think the blimp was very low in terms of who was affected. And I also, you know, something else which I kind of I believe is – well, there's several ways of interpreting it in general. If we're looking at just from the bigger scope of, hey, would the internet ever go down, or is there, you know, what do we do to combat it? On one hand, we have, you know, there are people who do try and do malicious things, mm-hmm. but also with the same regard, there are quite a lot of people who, you know, you've got your black hat hackers, but you also have your white hat hackers. So you have a combating force, a force for good, which will always, you know, which will combat the others too. So I think that struggle is going to, I don't think one side is going to completely win over the other. I would say bringing down the internet would be potentially a complete win for one side rather than the other, and I don't see that ever happening. And the other case is the I think the more outstanding case is these individuals, you know, even people doing malicious things, they rely on the internet and would never want to bring something of that magnitude down for, you know, as long a period, or at least that's my belief, because, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, right?
It's the equivalent of a virus killing the host that supports it,
right? Or it's equivalent of, you know, sending out a virus, but also saying that you are willing to infect yourself in that same cause. Right. And I think when you think about that, that number diminishes quite rapidly. I don't know. It definitely was just a blimp. And I think they're making quite a lot more fuss than it really is.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. We do hear about these things when it actually does happen. Typically, more often than not, it's like the Amazon Web Services that a lot of major corporations subscribe to and are using as their cloud services that go down. And then we'll hear it'll affect Netflix as well as a number of other services for half a day or a few hours, but never on the scale that is being reported here.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Okay, moving on here. Yahoo grabbed attention Monday when it announced its intention to acquire mobile newsreader Sumly, the brainchild of 17-year-old Nick D'Alozio, for a reported $30 million. He promptly became Yahoo's youngest employee, 17 years old. At the same time, Yahoo is embarking on an ambitious summer-long marketing campaign to woo the under 34 demographic, says Chief Marketing Officer Kathy Savitt. We own adults 34 and older, but we plan to reintroduce Yahoo to the younger demographic. This move comes as some younger users are showing signs of Facebook fatigue and flocking to Instagram feed and Snapchat. Yahoo, with about 700 million monthly users, is seeking to mine a rich vein of 18 to 34-year-olds who are deeply engaged online and tend to spend more. Tosin, have you ever used Sumly?
I have not. Have you?
I have not, but it seemed really interesting when I read about what it does. It's basically like a newsreader, like a Flipboard, but a little bit more elegant and with some sort of like intuitive. It's got some sort of intuitive AI that will take that will parse a long article and break it down to like 240 words or something very small and bite-sized enough to fit on the page that the single page that you're looking in on, so you can get the entire article sort of summed up in one paragraph or two, and then you can choose to drill down into it and read more if you want, or just move on to the next article. I think this is a good move for Yahoo. I don't know. I mean, it's clear what they're trying to do. I mean, they're basically trying to, as they said, trying to get the younger demographic.
This actually reminds me of a app that I've enjoyed called Zeit. It's also reading that article, I didn't realize Zeit was owned by CNN now, but it's a similar vein. And what I actually never realized is I think it also does some sort of algorithmic work to shorten articles when you're viewing it in the mobile view. Because I noticed when I switched to when I took the same article and pasted it in the web, and I noticed that there was a lot of things that had been cut out. So it reminds me of Zeit, which I really enjoy. I think the cost of it, $30 million, is probably it's not that bad for Yahoo, considering what they used to pay for different acquisitions that failed. Mm-hmm. I think that they still have a hard sell to go to get to young demographics, because there is this app, but there's also quite a lot of other apps at play when you start looking at that marketplace. They just have to continue seeking and doing things innovative. So I think this app is a step in the right direction, but there's a lot more that they have to do to get this to really target that demographic.
Let me just ask you, what do you think? What else do you think Yahoo should do along this vein to sort of get that younger demographic?
So that's really the tricky question there, and I think that's
that's the question we probably should be asking Marissa Mayer.
Yeah, that's the billion-dollar question,
yes,
right?
Yes.
It's kind of a struggle here because there's already this mindset of what Yahoo is, what
right.
Yahoo does, and I think you've got to really challenge that and just start. I want to say so. Let me preface this and say I understand that Yahoo may not have the same sort of pockets as Apple or especially as Google, and may not be in a position to take as great risks as those companies. But I find that one of the things that probably really helped Apple out of its time is that they just tried to do something innovative like the iPhone. Or even like Google with their pursuit of Google Glass. They're just thinking outside the box and saying, hey, people really like this. And it may not necessarily make you the money back, but at least it puts your company in that limelight and puts your company in a spot where people are now interested to see what you have to say. People are compelled to see that, oh, they're actually thinking innovatively. And maybe that even helps when looking to hire new developers, people who want to be who are interested in being able to get to challenge the current ecosystem and challenge how things are done and thought of. And so I know the examples I've given are more large scale, large scope, large investment things, but you can probably use that same sort of mantra on smaller, in a smaller scope, in not only
sure.
you know, with this, which is a step in that direction, but with other apps and other things you have in your ecosystem. I remember actually back in the day, Yahoo used to be pretty popular with games, right? They used to sure. have all these like chess games and things that people would
mini
play.
Games, the kind of thing like PopCap and you know, the kind of thing that that Facebook is known for now with Zynga and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, potentially maybe they could resurface that somehow. I'm not really sure. I think if I knew the answers, maybe I could jump on that train and become a CEO. But at least to start exploring those avenues and get yourself a new image. I don't know. Make a funny commercial.
All right. Well, I'm sure Marissa will be calling you any moment. At long last, T-Mobile will be carrying the Apple iPhone starting April 12th. The fourth place carrier announced the news during a press event in New York on Tuesday. As part of their new Uncarrier branding and initiative, it'll be selling the iPhone 5 slightly different than its competitors. Instead of pressing customers to sign a two-year agreement, T-Mobile will let iPhone buyers either pay full price for the device at the time of purchase or spread the cost over 24 months with installment plans. A 16-gig iPhone 5 will sell for $99 up front with 24 months of $20 payments a month. That's $579 over 2 years, $70 less than buying an unlocked iPhone 5 from Apple. Similarly, the iPhone 4S will cost $69.99 down plus $20 per month, and the iPhone 4 will cost $14.99 plus a $15 monthly charge. Unfortunately, there's no word yet on what happens if you cancel your plan or want to buy a new phone before those 24 months are up. Although I think that they want it to make it so that you can leave at any time. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what happens if you leave before those 24 months, do you have to give the phone back or what?
Yeah, those will be the interesting questions to have answered. But I will say it's – well, for Apple, they must be loving it. You know, that's another space to be in yeah. That you can potentially get new people onboarded. But I think T-Mobile is looking to – same thing as like Yahoo is looking to kind of breathe new life into their organization. I personally – so I used to have T-Mobile, and I actually really loved T-Mobile. Good service, really good customer support, which is a vital aspect for any company. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's still the same way, but at the time, I used to love it. And the only reason I switched to AT&T was for the original iPhone. So, you know, it's good to see that they've finally gotten on the bandwagon, and I wish them the best. I don't know. Have you ever – what do you use for service right now?
I'm with AT&T. Like I was with AT&T before the iPhone, and then when the iPhone came out, well, AT&T was like the only choice. So I've been with them ever since. But and I also have a unlimited data plan with them that I've – you know, I've grandfathered with them with every iteration of the iPhone.
Likewise. Gotta love the grandfather clause. Yes. Let's hope that doesn't go away.
Right. Which is, I think, is probably the main reason why I've still stuck with AT&T at this point.
Yeah.
Okay. We are going to take a short break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible's offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to recommend this week is called Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead by Sheryl Sandberg. Sheryl Sandberg is Facebook's chief operating officer. She's ranked 8th on Fortune's list of the 50 most powerful women in business, has become one of America's most galvanizing leaders and an icon for millions of women juggling work and family. In Lean In, she urges women to take risks and seek new challenges to find work that they love and to remain passionately engaged with it at the highest levels throughout their lives. This whole book is based on a TED Talk that she did a few years ago, and I just watched that TED Talk a short while before we started the podcast. It's really engaging. I mean, it's really sort of engaging and energizing to women who are struggling to make all the ends meet in business and be just as respected as their male counterparts in business. So I recommend this book. If you like it, it's yours for free. Even if you don't like the Audible service and you want to end your commitment to the Audible service, you can still get to keep the book for free. And to download that free audiobook or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and 30-day trial to check out their service. Using that URL helps us here on the show. So if you've never joined Audible before, this is your time to try it. It's the way that I read books now primarily these days. So we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return... Ever made an off-color remark at a work event when you thought no one else was listening? You might want to think twice about that after hearing our next story. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Tosin Anafowakin. In an age of blogs, tweets, Hacker News, Reddit, and Anonymous, an off-the-cuff joke can spin wildly out of control. At least it appears that's what happened with PyCon last week when a sexual joke led to some very public firings, a virulent debate about women in technology, another virulent debate about public shaming, and a DDoS attack. So here's what happened according to Kim Mai Cutler in TechCrunch. While sitting in the 10th row of a Python programming conference, a developer who works for startup Playhaven apparently made a joke about big dongles and forking someone's repo. Adria Richards, a developer evangelist sitting in front of them, called them out on Twitter and in a blog post for making the conference environment unwelcoming toward women. PyCon then escorted them out of the hallway. Shortly afterwards, Playhaven said it had fired the developer, and their CEO said, and I'm quoting here, "As a company that is dedicated to gender equality and values honorable behavior, we conducted a thorough investigation. The result of this investigation led to the unfortunate outcome of having let this employee go." The unnamed fired employee showed up on Hacker News by the name of Mr. Hank and apologized for the joke. He said, "I really didn't mean to offend anyone, and I really do regret the comment and how it made Adria feel. She had every right to report me to staff, and I defend her position. However, there is another side to the story. While I did make a big dongle joke about a fictional piece of hardware that I identified as male, no sexual jokes were made about forking. My friends and I had decided forking someone's repo is a new form of flattery, the highest form being implementation, and we were excited about one of the presenter's projects. A friend said, I would fork that guy's repo. The sexual context was applied by Adria and not by us. My second comment is this. Adria has an audience and is a successful person of the media. With that great power and reach comes responsibility. As a result of the picture she took, I was let go of my job today. She gave me no warning. She smiled when she snapped the pic and sealed my fate. Let this serve as a message to everyone. Our actions and words, big or small, can have a serious impact. After news the developer was let go came out, Adria Richards said that she didn't intend for him to get fired. Then she started getting some incredibly degrading criticism on her Facebook page and on Twitter. PyCon is still discussing how to change its code of conduct around reporting incidents like this. And just hours ago after that incident had occurred, Adria Richards' employer, SendGrid, had received a DDoS attack from Anonymous, saying that they were going to attack the infrastructure if the startup didn't fire Richards. And then Adria Richards was then terminated by SendGrid. And their CEO posted the rationale for firing her, saying basically they disagree with how she handled responding to the joke so publicly and say that she's no longer going to be effective in her role in the company as evangelist. It's incredibly unfortunate. This whole series of events is incredibly unfortunate, and it feels like... It feels like none of it really had to happen if things had been approached in a different way. But I'm not entirely sure how I would have handled this situation, other than maybe if I were Adria Richards, I would have confronted the person who said the off-color remark personally and let them know how I felt. And given them an opportunity to, you know, apologize and either, you know, and either say that they weren't going to do it anymore or explain themselves. I don't know. What did you think about this situation?
Yeah, it's a really tricky situation because, kind of like you said, in an ideal world, you would want the, you know, in an ideal world, face to face. Communication often is the best because we all know from this internet day and age that written word can be misconstrued. Sarcasm can also be easily misconstrued. So in an ideal world, I would have loved for her to be able to talk to the individuals behind them. I would have loved, you know, if she wasn't comfortable with that, I would have loved for her to simply just engage PyCon staff and let it run its course that way. But you know, sometimes people aren't comfortable with either of those methods. And you're on one hand, perhaps it's not fair to force these ideologies on individuals when we don't necessarily know where she's coming from in terms of, you know, instances where she's had to deal with similar circumstances.
Sure.
I mean, it's definitely, it's unfortunate on multiple regards, you know, the individuals losing their jobs, the nature of the commentary that this lady has been receiving, which is definitely not condonable. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's one of the things that it actually makes me think of is, you know, Google. Imagine Google Glass in this situation, right?
Yes. I'm so glad you brought that up.
The worries people have with Google Glass could easily be extended upon very simply in this case. And I don't know. On another hand, it also makes you think that. It makes you think, you know, what if, kind of as I was telling you before, there are a lot of other things that we talk about simplistically.
Yeah.
For example, in a scenario I had brought up to some people we were discussing about this. What if you were talking about a restaurant called Dick's, or, you know, there are restaurants called, you know,
Hooters.
BJ's or Hooters or whatnot, and someone overhears you talking about it and doesn't know the context in which it originates, takes your picture, posts it online. You know, while that could have some negative effects on both on yourself or potentially the other individual, without having a sort of context in which to rely upon. So it's interesting. What was your take on it, as well as looked like you had something unique to say about Google Glass in this situation?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's in this particular case, the Adria Richards, the person who was offended, turned around and snapped a picture and then tweeted it. And, you know, it was one sort of isolated incident, but in a world where live streaming from the everything that you witness is a possibility with something like Google Glass, are we going to turn into the kind of society where everything we say in public is an actionable, you know, could be an actionable situation where we have to really guard everything that we say? I know we should take responsibility for everything we say or do, but there are a lot of times when the conversations that we have in public are really private conversations between ourselves and the people who are in our immediate vicinity. So how does that extend in a world where there are cameras on people's faces everywhere?
And yeah, it becomes a world where there is no concept of privacy.
Right. And I think that's, to me, that's sort of the bigger picture here, the bigger unspoken picture here. And the thing that sort of concerns me the most about the world of always connected, you know, the world of Google Glass, essentially. But, you know, as far as this goes, there was a blogger, Amanda Bloom, and she had some interesting words to say about this situation. Basically, she said, we were all the losers in this scenario. Adria's employer, SendGrid, lost. They had an opportunity to build toward a positive resolution, and they instead lost business and lost a good employee. The developer in question didn't win. He posted a very classy apology, but he lost his job. Adria lost, obviously, her own job. And she says, most importantly, women didn't win. The ugliness I've seen in the last week shocks me. I didn't know it could sink to such depths. Adria reinforced the idea of us as threats to men, as unreasonable, as hard to work with, as bitches. Her firing in some way sanctifies the ugly things said to her as effective. The social terrorism one, it doesn't heal the divide, it slices it deeper. By that default, men lost too. You know, I don't know. I don't know how to effectively handle situations like this in the future. I think maybe the right way would be just to personally express your concern to the other person involved, and not to the World Wide Web. Try and resolve the situation on a personal level first.
Yeah, you know, like I said, ideally, I would hope that people would be comfortable in that situation, either, you know, expressing it in there rather than using our other social media out as mechanisms for an outcry of that nature, especially when you may not necessarily have the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
Start small before going big, but you know that's not necessarily always the way things shake out. And it is just, it's unfortunate, the turn of events. And hopefully each of these parties will grow from the situation.
Yes.
And it, at least one positive is we're having some social discourse about it and reflecting on it and hopefully using it to influence our future decisions and how we go about things in life.
I completely agree. Okay, moving on here. HBO could widen access to its HBO Go online streaming service by teaming up with broadband internet providers for customers who do not subscribe to a cable TV service. According to HBO's CEO, right now we have the right model. Maybe HBO Go with our broadband partners could evolve. He said that HBO Go could be packaged with a monthly internet service in partnership with broadband providers, reducing the cost. For example, customers could pay $50 a month for their broadband internet and an extra $10 or $15 for HBO to be packaged in with that service for a total of $60 to $65 a month. We'd have to make the math work, he says. HBO, owned by Time Warner, relies on a large financial support from its cable and satellite TV partners to help distribute and promote its shows. Internet-only rivals such as Netflix and Amazon are trying to disrupt this approach by delivering original programming directly over the internet. It's a challenge to HBO, however, it would be a risky step for the company to bypass its traditional distribution partners, which provide HBO with lucrative subscription fees. There are billions of dollars generated from HBO's existing distribution network, and to simply circumvent that doesn't make any business sense. But it doesn't mean that we are not mindful that the problem exists, says their CEO. What do you think about this? Do you think that HBO should allow people to get access to HBO Go without having to be members of their subscription service?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a long time coming. There are so many people out there who, at least they say it. Now, I don't know if they necessarily mean it, but I'm going to take them at their face value. But say that they would purchase specific shows or just specific HBO package if they didn't have to do it in cable. And I think you actually see that to a certain extent with the people who've switched over to things like Hulu Plus or even Netflix. People want to be able to consume the media which they want in easy fashion and not get a lot of the extra stuff that comes with it. I can tell you, I think it's really been a long time coming here because although – and you know what? Let me make a bigger statement here. Mm-hmm. The companies that succeed are the companies that are able to successfully pivot based off what their consumers – want. And we find that there are a lot of industries here where that pivot is slow and takes ages and may not necessarily have. And ultimately, I think for a lot of those companies, it ends up being their downfall. It ends up being that they start to gain this negative experience or prerogative from their users. And you know, I think for some companies, they've been able to rely as being the only player in the market. But when that changes, you know, they will end up being the first out the door. So I think that it's a good thing to see that HBO is kind of listening to the public and potentially trying to see if they can make this work. Because right now, it's not like by holding on to this, it's not like you're losing money by putting this into play. Yeah, ultimately, you're probably going to gain a lot more money than you would lose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that basically the bottom line for me is that people want to be able to consume their content in the way that by their own terms, and there are enough competing forces in the marketplace that they can do that. And if the competition does not concede to them, there are other places that they can go. You know, George R.R. Martin, the Game of Thrones creator, said during a recent premiere for season 3 that piracy really hasn't affected their revenues at all. In fact, people who have pirated their show typically end up buying the box sets at the end of the season anyway. And I can agree with him on that point.
Yeah.
In other video streaming news, Spotify, the on-demand music service, is planning a major change. According to two sources briefed On the company's plan, Spotify intends to become an on-demand music and video service, one that would invest in original content and compete heads-on with Netflix. Ultimately, Spotify's metamorphosis would also put it into competition with content creators and providers such as HBO. I think this is big news, and I think it's a great. I think the more competitors there are in the marketplace, the better. It just means a better range of choices for us as consumers. And I'm already a Spotify subscriber, so more power to them.
Yeah, definitely more power to them. I think it's going to be a tricky market to break into, but they do have their following. I know a lot of people who subscribe, and I think I was a late user of Spotify because I'm just not a fan of having to tie my Facebook account to anything else when I can avoid it. And so I stayed away, but I started using it when I moved to California, and I don't know if I've ever really looked back since. So they put out good stuff, and let's see what else they can try.
Yep. Looking forward to seeing this. Okay, March 21st was Twitter's birthday, their 7-year anniversary, and rather than just celebrate the anniversary of the now ubiquitous online social networking and microblogging service, I thought I'd take a few moments here to ask, how can Twitter be made better for the future, and what do you think its biggest challenges are moving forward?
So, one of the challenges for Twitter, I think, is their influx, so their size. They're going to, at some point, have to go public, or at least that's my belief, that at some point they have to go public, and it looks like that's their ultimate plan. And it's one of the things which I struggle with is consumer products, or at least consumer applications, are really hard to be – it's a hard market to be profitable in because consumers are pretty volatile and in terms of spending are very choosy. And with so many good free applications out there, there are always other choices which are lower costs. Unlike, in the enterprise market where, companies are not really worried – well – to a certain extent, companies are less worried about the cost of a solution as long as it meets their needs. So I think a big challenge for them is how they're going to monetize their service. You see it at times with different ads in their feeds, but they also need to make sure that those ads are getting to the correct people, and that also the ads are not getting in the way of the experience for those users, because if they are, they'll stop using it. So I think that's a huge challenge for them, how to become profitable with their service. What do you think?
Obviously, yeah, they need to monetize. They need to find some way to sort of effective way. Like I've always said from the get-go that one of the ways they should monetize is to have to feed like the broad fire hose stream of their API to sell that at a premium, because I think at the moment they only have a small segment going out to developers for use in their API, and they limit that how many calls can be made in an hour. And I think they could sell that as a premium, sell the full fire hose of data to people at a premium. I think they can also sell user statistic metrics to people based on the data they're collecting. They can sell that to marketers as well. I think above all, one of the articles that I linked to here mentions stagnation, and I think Twitter does feel a little stagnant. They haven't really evolved much. But I mean, the bigger question there is, do they need to? Is it working just fine the way it is? If it's not broke, don't fix it, or do they need to grow beyond the, you know, the 140 character microblogging service that they are?
Yeah, no, definitely agree there in terms of, you know, their future direction as a service. Now, you know, I am a big fan of Twitter.
Yeah.
And I think you are as well, too.
I am, yeah.
And I hope that they're able to be successful. But I also hope that they will take a similar mantra in which they act on behalf of their consumers and try and do no evil. They've made a lot of changes which kind of detract from that position. You know, doing a lot more limitations in what they allow developers to do on their platform and really tightening the britches around that. And I hope that's not a negative sign in the future. But for now, I'm still a fan. And you know, with all tech startups and companies, this fan, you wish them luck. You always fight for the I was going to say little guy, but they're not so little anymore.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think the way to go. I'm glad that they made it this far. How many social networks have lasted 7 years at this point? You can maybe count them on two hands.
Yeah, it's few and far between.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take another break here. Here's some more music. And when we return, wouldn't you like to see the dodo or woolly mammoth roaming the earth again? A group of scientists want to make that a reality. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Tosin Onofwakin. Last week at a TEDx conference in Washington, D.C., sponsored by National Geographic, scientists met to discuss which animals should be brought back from extinction. They also discussed the how, why, and ethics of doing so. They called it de-extinction, and it rests on a relatively simple premise you may have heard before. It involves taking old DNA samples, reassembling them into a full genome, which is then injected into embryonic cells which have had their own DNA taken out, and then finding a suitable living surrogate to give birth. The Washington Post reports that 10 years ago, a team of scientists from France and Spain almost brought back an extinct wild goat, but it only lived for 10 minutes. It raises a host of issues, including how scientists can get enough good sample of DNA from the extinct animal and whether they or not they should do it. There are a few guidelines for which ancient species are considered, and sadly, dinosaurs are so long dead they're not even in the picture. The DNA has long ago degraded, so researchers are fairly sure that something like Jurassic Park will never happen again. They chose the animals using the following criteria. Are the species desirable? Do they hold an important ecological function, or are they beloved by humans? Are the species practical choices? Do we have access to tissue that can give us good quality DNA samples or germ cells to reproduce the species? And are they able to be reintroduced into the world? Are the habitats in which they live available, and do we know why they went extinct in the first place? The cost of de-extinction varies by species, but projects could run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more. But if you were the zoo that had that one woolly mammoth or saber-toothed cat, these costs might just be worth it. What did you think about this this development? Would you like to see like the dodo and the saber-toothed cat roaming around again?
I don't know. You know, one of the first things which I thought to myself was, remember that article we talked about a while ago where they tried to bring back where they kind of reanimated a dead animal and all the other animals realized something was awry and started attacking it and basically ripped off his head?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was a robo sparrow, the robot sparrow.
Robo sparrow. That is the first thing that comes to mind. That when you start bringing back animals which had died due to, you know, maybe unfortunate circumstances, but died nonetheless, we will upset the balance of nature and nature will strike back in terms of, you know, other animals will say, hey, you're not really there, or there's something odd about you, and then lash out and we start this whole nuclear war of animals. So I think the first thing is just this odd thought regarding that. Second thing is, I'm not sure I really want to see saber-toothed tigers roaming around. It's an interesting concept, right? Bring back the dodo, bring back extinct animals, but then I wonder if that would also change the way people look at preservation and be like, well, if we can bring them back, we might as well continue, hunting and deforestation and doing other things that cause more harm than good. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever had a chance to think that deeply about it. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
On the one hand, I think in a sort of captivity situation like a zoo, I think seeing something like the dodo would be fascinating. But you know, there is that sort of wild notion that something like a Jurassic Park could happen, not necessarily T-Rex killing humans, but more in the fact that we're reintroducing a species who may not be accustomed to how the world has changed since it went extinct, and will we be reintroducing it just to have it die again?
I think the first thing which I actually think about is, for some reason, I have images of woolly mammoths and Futurama, of some like woolly mammoth chasing down Fry from Futurama, or Fry riding a woolly mammoth into battle against, you know, mankind. All hilarious images, but also somewhat scary.
I've heard people talk about, because there was a they had found this woolly mammoth in ice, and it's probably what they would use as the source for the DNA sample. The people had talked about the idea of cloning it and then harvesting it for meat and making woolly mammoth steaks. I don't know. That sounds a little horrific, but I'm still bizarrely sort of curious about that situation. Not that I would eat one myself, but all right. I think that's our last story, unless you have anything else that you want to cover.
You know what? I will end with one last PAX tale.
Yeah, yeah.
One last, apart from the ridiculous stuff which I do at PAX, which one of these days I'll give you a whole story about the ambassador for Paxcadia prank that happened this year. But I do want to mention this game, which wasn't really something that occurred at PAX, but I finally got to play Johann Sebastian's Joust, which has been around for a while, and it's just an excellent game where you use, basically it's, you have several Move controllers and a laptop which plays some Bach, and depending on the speed of the music, you can move to that same tempo, and the goal is to jostle your opponent's controllers so that they move faster than the pace of the music, and are therefore eliminated. I got to play that, and on the surface, you know, when I had first watched videos of it, it looked unique but not that entertaining, but it was just a lot of fun. And then I actually got to try a special variant of the game, which took place in complete darkness, which was even better. So if when that game finally does come out for people to try, or if you have any demonstrations in your local neck of the woods, definitely go try it out, because it's a wild time.
Yeah, this is a this was a indie game. That the interesting thing about this, because I saw this last year at E3 as well. During E3, every year they have a section of E3 that's called Indiecade, and it's basically a showcase of indie games. And what I found fascinating about this was an indie game that was developed with using the Sony Move controllers, but otherwise not using the PlayStation 3 at all. It was just using the controllers as the interface, and essentially the idea is that you're in this sort of sumo ring while this music is being played, and you kind of have to push your opponent to the point that his Move controller jostles enough that he's out of the game. While at the same time trying to defend yourself from being jostled. I saw this being played with one of the participants in this in the demo that I saw was Ashley Birch, who I don't know if you know who that is, but she hosts a podcast called "Hey Ash, What You Playing?"
I've met them actually.
Oh, the Birches, yep. Ashley and Anthony.
Yeah. Yep, pretty fun people.
So so she was playing the I actually have video of it. Maybe I'll crack it out and throw it on the post for this week. But I thought that was one of the most fascinating sort of indie games that I saw, only because they completely thought out of the box when it came to the idea of both the idea of an indie game and the fact that they were using these controllers in a completely unconventional way.
Yeah, and the developer is really great individual, definitely fun, I definitely look forward to what they have in store for the future.
Cool. All right, well, let me wrap it up by asking you, Tosin, where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T, 4321, as well as you can find my random ramblings and a recap of this year's PAX prank coming up soon on the Irresponsible Random Chatter, IRC webcast.blogspot.com.
All right, as for myself, you can find me at facebook.com/MrBabyMan and twitter.com/MrBabyMan and MrBabyMan.com. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And please, if you like us, tell your friends and write a review. Our show's on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to Stitcher.com. We're also at Facebook.com/TheDrillDown and Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.